Good afternoon, and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of arts and cultural affairs. I'm David LaTulipe, and I am particularly grateful to the founding host of this program for entrusting me to its stewardship. Alan's taught me a great deal about the art of broadcasting, and his style is inimitable. I'll do my best to continue in these very large shoes to fill, and I, along with the rest of the KLW staff, wish him only the best. Thanks also to Matt Martin for expressing confidence in my abilities to carry this show forward. This week on Open Air, a visit from Bill English of the San Francisco Playhouse to talk about their new season, including the season opener, which is a rock musical called Bloody, Bloody Andrew Jackson. Albanian-born tenor Saimir Pirgu will be in to talk about his role in Bellini's The Capulets and Montagues, now at SF Opera, and it marks his debut with the company. And Peter Robinson and Diane Keough stop by with some reviews and recommendations for your nightlife. Well, let's begin with some music. Here is tenor Saimir Pirgu with an excerpt from Donizetti's Elixir of Love, Una Fortiva Lagrima.
Thank you.
tenor Saimir Pirigu, my guest here on Open Air. Saimir, welcome to KLW.
Buongiorno.
Buongiorno, indeed. What a fantastic live record. Where was that recorded?
This is recording in Rome, 2010 or 11. I'm not sure now, but yes, Teatro dell'Opera Roma.
Fantastic. Well, it must have been quite a run for you there.
Yeah, it was a fantastic production at Rome.
As a tenor, you must be drawn to these really juicy arias like that. Is it something that you look forward to? You must. You must look forward to singing something like the Donizetti.
Yeah, I think for tenor, it's a big problem because everybody is waiting for this famous aria. And all pressure for Turandot, Nessun Dorma, all Una Furtiva Lacrima, and then people are staying and waiting two hours. And it's a big passion for a tenor to sing this aria or the other aria. But, you need to be a good way and to wait your time and to be calm.
Sure, sure. Now, that's also a bel canto role. Would that be considered a bel canto? Or as I used to refer to it in my undergrad studies, can belto.
No, just a bel canto is bel singing, to
sure.
Sing well. I mean, it's with the line and wonderful musicality, and the sound will be much, much beautiful in the other repertoire. I mean, in the Verdi or Puccini, you can sing a little bit loud, but in this repertoire, it's not possible. You need to be very careful with the line because the structure of the composer, they don't permit you to sing more louder or then you can be alone because
right. It's
nothing right. In the orchestra. I mean.
Well, you mentioned the burden you have of perhaps singing a very famous aria and having the audience expectation. You probably don't have that for this Bellini work, which is off of people's radar and perception of operas. This is Bellini's Capulets and the Montagues. Has that been in your repertoire? Or is this new to you as well?
No, it's my first time I'm singing Bellini. But it's still in the beginning of bel canto. I mean, Bellini is completely bel canto. But I never sing Bellini before for a big reason. It's very difficult to sing bel canto. And this is a real bel canto. And anyway, the role is not so important because Capuletti and Montecchi is for Romeo and Juliet. And they are two protagonists. And she is mezzo-soprano and the other one is soprano. And the tenor is not so important in this opera, but it's very difficult because it's the same time when the Donizetti, Bellini, all these composers, bel canto composer, did these beautiful arias. And but the problem in this Capuletti Montecchi is that everything for tenor is at the beginning of the opera, and then it's not a really really big opera for a tenor, are more for the two other protagonists.
Your role is as Tebaldo.
Yeah.
And you also have a wonderful cast on supporting you and around you. Joyce DiDonato is as Romeo.
Romeo, yes.
Romeo. Wow.
She is fantastic. I mean, I met her 10 years ago. We did together in Pesaro Festival, Orsini Opera Festival in Pesaro, Opera Adina. And after 10 years we're singing together in Capuletti Montecchi. I mean, it's a pleasure to sing with her. And also with Nicole Cabal. They are two fantastic singers. And I'm very happy to sing with them.
Well, the opera, San Francisco Opera has offered us a brief excerpt from the Bellini for broadcast. For other reasons, we can't do too much. But perhaps you could share with us what we're about to hear from this particular aria that you're going to sing.
I mean, the aria from the tenor is just a beautiful aria. Then the beginning of the opera, and he just singing for this life of he's in life with Giulietta, and he's singing a beautiful L'amo tanto e me si cara. He's just singing for a beautiful Giulietta.
All right, here we go. An excerpt from Bellini's The Capulets and the Montagues, sung by Sergio Pirigu here on Open Air. From the current production of San Francisco opera Bellini's The Capulets and the Montagues.
Saimir.
Saimir Pirgu. Thank you. Saimir Pirgu.
Yes, it's not so easy.
Well, let's talk about your upbringing. You were born in 1981. You're a rising star in the opera scene. Tell us about your training in Albania.
I mean,
where else you studied.
At this time, when I was just 6 years old, I was playing violin and at the school, but I realized that I can be a tenor with the concert of three tenors in Caracalla. And then it was 1995 when I watched this in television.
Uh-huh.
And after this moment, I said, probably I will be a tenor. Probably can I go to some teachers and asking if I can sing or I can do something. And One day I met some professor of canto in my school, and then he said, you are a wonderful tenor, but you need to leave Albania and to go in Italy or some other place and probably to find somebody that he can teach you. And it was like this. I finished the school for violin, and I take my luggage, and I was going in Italy to sing there. And, yeah, was in 2 years, I win two competition, Caruso and Tito Schipa. And after this two big competition, Maestro Claudio Abbado was asking me to sing with him. And it was a pretty fast, everything very fast, but yeah, was my start.
Fantastic.
A product of three tenors.
Well, you brought with, we're going to sample a little bit more of your music from Idomeneo, some Mozart.
Yeah.
Could you set up what we're going to...
This is a production from Opera Zurich with conductor Nicolaus Harnoncourt. And yeah, it's one of the most beautiful roles that I sing. And yeah, probably better to hear this.
Vedromi intorno
is the first aria of the first act
from Mozart's Idomeneo.
Ovunque io miro tutto di pace in sé, riposa e gode. Io sol su quest'arli di spiagge, da panno e da disagio steguato, quella calma o nettuno e meno provo, che al tuo regno impetrai. And not che giorno.
Music of Mozart, as sung by Saimir Pirgu, my guest here on Open Air. Good afternoon. I'm David Latulippe. Saimir Pirgu appearing in his debut at the San Francisco Opera. Some wonderful singing, Saimir.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So the production of The Capulets and the Montagues runs through October 19th at the War Memorial Opera House. It's conducted by Ricardo Frizza and directed by Vincent Bussard. It's a new production designed by Vincent Lemaire and costumes by Christian Lacroix.
Yes.
So you're well-dressed for this production.
Yes, I want to buy this costume that I have, but it's not possible. He doesn't give the permits to give it. It's a beautiful leather, and yeah. I think I like this production because it's very, very beautiful, and the costume are amazing.
Do you prefer a more traditional approach to productions at this stage in your life?
I'm not so... For me, it's not important if the production is modern or classic, or it's just a good idea of production or not good. It's a bad production or beautiful production. If the modern is good, it's beautiful, for me, it's okay. For me, it's more important what these stage directors want to say to people, and then everything new can be, if it's beautiful, can be wonderful. Why not?
Sure. Well, I wish you the very best with this production. And tell me what's coming up next for you.
Next in United States would be only Metropolitan Opera that I will sing there, La Traviata.
Oh, fantastic.
And with two wonderful singers, Diana Damrau, she is my Violetta, and my father can be Placido Domingo. He's singing German.
Oh, God. Wow.
I'm very excited about this.
This will be your Met debut as well?
No. I sang it at the Met before. This will be the second or third time. Yeah.
Well, let's call it a triumphant return to the Metropolitan Opera.
Yeah, I hope.
And we wish you the very best. Thanks so much for taking
some
time
today. Thank you very much.
Tenor Saimir Pirgu. Stay with me here on Open Air. Peter Robinson will be talking about some things that are upcoming in the cultural front, as will Diane Keough, and next to talk with Bill English of SF Playhouse. This is Open Air on KALW. Listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW. Good afternoon once again. I'm David Latulippe, joined now by Bill English of the SF Playhouse. Bill, welcome back to KALW.
Hey, thanks. Good to see you.
In learning about this season, I didn't realize that SF Playhouse is celebrating its 10th anniversary season. Fantastic.
Yeah, it's great. We've been through 9 full years, starting out on a decade, so we're pretty thrilled about that.
In addition to this opening rock musical called Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, can you tell us a little bit about what the rest of the season is bringing?
Well, we do a very eclectic mix. We're a subscription-based season. We have 6 shows in our main stage season, and there's a pretty tremendous variety of them. Bloody Bloody is the first of the season, followed by something very traditional, Bell, Book, and Candle by John Van Druten. So many of you may have remember the movie with Jimmy Stewart and Kim Novak and Jack Lemmon. We're following that with a title that I can't fully say on the air, I believe, but I can go as far perhaps as to say The Mother Bleeper with the Hat. And that's a really wonderful show that was a hit on Broadway last year, about a young man who's in recovery and trying to get himself back on track. His wife is not quite recovered, and he comes home one day and finds a strange hat, man's hat, on the chair in his living room. And so that's from whence comes his story. We're following that with a play by Neil LaBute called Reasons to Be Pretty, which is a wonderfully cynical and tough exploration of our American fascination with beauty and our tendency to not see beneath the skin to the real person underneath. And that was also a hit on Broadway. We're following that with a kind of a British cult classic called Abigail's Party. That's by Mike Leigh, the great film director, and Abigail's Party began Mike Leigh's career. And the play is from the late 70s and became a huge cult hit in London. They made a film out of it, which almost every person with a British accent has seen. And it seems like every 4 or 5 years on the West End, there's a revival of Abigail's Party. And I like to describe it as sort of a British Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf that's funnier.
Okay.
It's kind of an all-night drunken suburban party between two couples who have absolutely nothing in common. And we're following that with a little seldom performed play by Arthur Miller, which is called The Man Who Had All the Luck. And it's a wonderful script. It was actually his first play produced. And although it didn't succeed at the time in the early 40s, it's been revived successfully in London and in New York. And it's a really wonderful, wonderful script. It's sort of the young Arthur Miller developed his vocabulary and stretched his talent.
I also see that you have what's called a sandbox season. Could you tell us a little bit about what that means?
Yes, the sandbox season is a sort of an adjunct season, and it's two world premieres, plays that have never been performed anywhere. And they are plays that we have commissioned. We have 6 playwrights currently writing new plays for the San Francisco Playhouse, and 2 of those new plays will appear in our sandbox. The idea is to create sort of a low-cost, lower stakes playground or sandbox, if you will, where new work can be developed with the writer present, and the writer's there every day with a director and a professional cast, and we kind of keep the production values under control so the budget doesn't get too high.
Sure, I'm sure.
But it's just a great laboratory.
Putting on live theater is ridiculously expensive, and it's interesting they have a nice little workshop feel to that.
Well, it's kind of trying to bridge the gap between what many theaters do, which is readings of new plays and then full-scale, fully mounted productions. This is trying to find sort of a middle ground where young playwrights can cut their teeth and get a review and get an audience into their work.
Very nice. Now, for listeners who may not be familiar with SF Playhouse, you were founded in 2003 by yourself and Susie Damilano.
Yes.
And I understand you're moving into a larger space now.
Yes. This will be our third venue. We were at 536 Sutter for 3 years, and then we moved across the street to 533 Sutter, which is both were 100-seat venues. And we've kind of outgrown the Sutter address. We've been turning away up to 1,000 people per run of show, and our staff has also been growing. There's just no room for anybody. You find people, you know, in the corner on the floor with laptops, and so we just needed more space all around. And the opportunity to move into the theater at 450 Post, which is in the Kensington Park Hotel, it's on the second floor above the Farallon restaurant, came up, and so we jumped at it, and we actually took over the space on September 17th.
Wow.
And we're opening our first production this coming Saturday, October 13th. So it's been a mad dash to make minor renovations in the auditorium and to get the word out and load in the set.
But it must say something for your subscriber base and your base of support that is allowing this to go forward.
Yeah, we have nearly 2,000 subscribers now. And That gives us a lot of security because we know we're going to have at least that many people who show up to every show. Subscribers are pretty much the soul of our operation. They people that have faith in us that buy a ticket to all six shows, and they give us the courage to take risks on edgy material like Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson and Reasons to Be Pretty. But we also love to do American classics. We just completed a long record-breaking run of My Fair Lady. So that's what you tend to get from San Francisco Playhouse. You'll go from My Fair Lady to Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson to Bell Book and Candle to the Mother Bleeper with the Hat.
And Arthur Miller at the end of the
variety,
season.
Yeah, a lot of variety.
Well, let's back up to this upcoming premiere of Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. It was written by Alex Timbers, the music and lyrics by Michael Friedman. Now, being an election year, of course, that's probably what drew you to have this at this particular time, at this particular venue, with this particular subject.
It did seem like a good slot to put the play into. I saw the play a couple of years ago at the Public Theater and fell in love with it immediately and was pretty much determined and maniacal in my pursuit of acquiring the rights to produce it in San Francisco. I just felt like it had a really original take on the American political system. You know, you simply have to suspend your disbelief to the degree that our seventh president was a rock star. And he does all the same things. The history in the play is quite accurate. He just has an electric guitar and sings.
Well, there are parallels because he was really the first populist president.
Yeah, absolutely. He was the first president born outside the 13 colonies, the first president born on the frontier, and the first president not from that East Coast aristocratic Federalist Party, which had dominated all politics up through the sixth president. So he actually founded the Democratic Party, and he did. He was the first. He sort of invented American populism, for better or for worse.
When Alex Timbers first brought this out, he originally thought, well, people are going to create the comparison to Bush Clinton. And then he mentioned, well, now it's more Obama Palin. And
right.
Now it's, you know, Obama Romney. And I think he referred to it as trying to create a Brechtian political satire rather than framing
Absolutely.
It to anyone.
Absolutely. I think it's what I've learned by working on it is that it. You can take it a lot of different ways. You know, it doesn't have a specific political axe to grind. It's just a very interesting commentary on the way Americans do politics. You know, it's interesting because all the cast members, many of the characters in the play were in their 40s and 50s when all this occurred. But the show is written for people who are in their 20s. And I think the intent, Mr. Timbers and Mr. Friedman's intent, is to portray this not only as a country which was very, very young in 1824 to 28, but a country which is still young and still really developing its identity. And it's really fun to look back to a time when many of the elements of the American character were being formed by this, you know, wild man from the frontier who took Washington by storm.
Let's hear a little bit of an excerpt from Bloody Bloody, I want to say Michael Jackson, Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. This is the musical by Alex Timbers, a brief excerpt here on Open Air.
Just shoot me in the head, cause you know I'd be better off dead. If there's really no place in America for celebrity in the first rank.
Ladies and gentlemen,
Governor Andrew Jackson! Yeah! That's right! Jackson's back! Oh, one, two, three, John Adams tried to be an American Idol. Jefferson tried to be a rock star. Madison tried to make a person in the Bible. James Monroe was a douchebag. The story always ends the same. It's hard to handle all that fame. You don't really have it in ya. Oh, oh, oh. There's no place in democracy for your brand of aristocracy. Take that to Virginia. Why don't you just shoot me in the head? Cause you know I'd be better off. If there's really no place in America, celebrity with a curse.
a brief excerpt from Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson.
Yeah, that's a great song.
It's called Rockstar.
Rockstar, yeah. It's when he actually hits the campaign trail in his successful election. He ran for office in 1824 and won the most popular votes. But through a technicality, you know, he didn't have a majority. And at that time, if you didn't have a majority, it may still be true that there's a runoff in the House. And there was a lot of infighting Washington backroom politics. And John Quincy Adams was actually made president. So he actually was kind of robbed of the presidency in 1824. So he was very depressed and went back to sulk at the Hermitage and then ran again in 1828. And this song sums up the sort of, you know, crazed election fervor with which he attacked the campaign trail in 1828.
Well, talk to me a little bit more about the rest of the plot. Bloody, bloody Andrew Jackson. Where does the bloody, bloody fit in? And where is this play taking us, the musical?
Well, Jackson was a wild man. I mean, he made a name for himself sort of protecting settlers. You know, that was one of his beefs with Washington, is there was no military presence on the frontier, and the frontiersmen were sort of left to themselves. And so he sort of took the cause of the frontier people and went out to protect them, and did it kind of on his own. He formed his own militia. He actually drove the Spanish out of Florida without asking the permission of Washington. And was attempting to drive the Indians west of the Mississippi, and there was a lot of conflict with Washington over whether that should be done, and he kind of just did it anyway. And he went down to New Orleans and drove the British out of America, proved for finally that Americans could defend their land on their own soil. So he was a soldier. And so the bloody, bloody part of it kind of comes from that. You know, he actually sort of invented the concept of manifest destiny. As the script says, he put the man in manifest destiny.
Interesting. Right.
And so the bloody, bloody, it sort of fits him. Some people, historians, as they look back on Andrew Jackson, I mean, some think of him as a great, great forefather who did establish manifest destiny, tripled the size of our actual country at the time, but also led his driving the Indians caused the exodus that we know as the Trail of Tears, you know, where many, many, many thousands of Indians died on the march. And so some people sort of describe him as an American Hitler. And these topics come up in the show, not with a judgment, because the show also sort of draws you into a compassionate understanding of what it may have been like to be him in that wild frontier, and trying to make some sense out of what he intended to do to protect his... He always thought of the frontier people as his family, and he was determined to protect them. And it didn't really matter by any means necessary, I believe, was where he was coming from. So there was a lot of blood.
Can you share with us a little bit about the cast that's been assembled for this?
Well, we have a fantastic cast. They're all really young and all amazingly talented. We realized when we started working on the play that we probably couldn't afford to cast 11 people to play the roles. And, of course, all the actors play many roles. They're putting hats on and off in capes and pants and shirts about as fast they turn around and they become somebody else. But there, we didn't really have the budget to be able to also hire a band. So the cast is the band. And practically everyone in the cast plays a musical instrument. We have about 5 guitar players. We have a wonderful bass player who's also a terrific actor, and a drummer who's a professional, you know, union actor. And then we also have a woman that plays the cello magnificently. And so, you know, when we were calling people in to audition, we would look to their resume to see if they played an instrument. It put them higher on the list.
And
we just did backflips when we found this young woman named Elle Bay, who plays the cello, which she's a fantastic actor, but plays the cello like a classical musician.
Well, you probably caught the version of Sweeney Todd where the musicians are the cast. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's kind of the same general principle, chamber musical, using members of the cast to be the band.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Anything beyond the season that you'd like to share with us?
Well, the venue's great. A lot of you may have been in the Post Street Theater. Before that, it was the Theater on the Square. But we came from a 100-seat theater, so we've actually reduced its capacity to about 250 people. So we're hoping to provide the grandeur of this really beautiful room with high ceilings and gorgeous friezes, you know, and artwork on the walls, and still kind of deliver the intimate experience that our patrons are used to.
Well, Bill, thanks so much for taking some time to talk with me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
More information about the SF Playhouse full season at sfplayhouse.org. And Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, which opens this Saturday, will be running through November 24th. Check it out, sfplayhouse.org. Thanks again, Bill.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to Open Air here on local public radio, KALW. Good afternoon. I'm David Latulipe, and I'm joined in studio now by a couple of Open Air stalwarts. Peter Robinson, who's going to inform us of some all kinds of activities coming up, and Diane Keough is making a return appearance. Hi, Diane.
Hi. It's great
Peter.
To be back.
Hi, David. Good to be here.
Diane, I understand you saw a musical recently. We were just talking about Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson.
Yeah, it's great. It was 42nd Street Moon. I've never been there before.
I have not either.
Oh, really? I would think that a city person would have, but it was kind of hard to find when you didn't know where you were. But we found it at the Eureka Theater, and the play is Of Thee I Sing, which was written in 1931 with music and lyrics by George and Ira Gershwin, but with the... The script was written by Kaufman, and it is so cleverly done, and it is so current, unfortunately, as it is today, because it's all political. And it's about someone who's going to become president, Mr. Wintergreen, of which there is a song in his name at the opening of the show. And he is delightful. He is single. He is handsome. He is charming. And he's completely unequipped to be president. However, with the Senate that they have, which is also unequipped to be really in the Senate, they decide the way they can get him to be president is to have a a beauty contest across the country and that the winner would be his wife, and that way it would be great. Well, of course, he doesn't fall in love with the one that won. He falls in love with a secretary person, and everybody's mad at him. He says, no, but we're going to run on love, and therefore love is sweeping the country. Comes the song, and it is so cleverly done.
Cue the orchestra.
Cue the orchestra. We're going to sing that, and then Of Thee I Sing, which of course is and Who Cares? Who cares if the banks fail in Yonkers? Well, that's another. I mean, it's so current that it's almost scary, but I've never been to that little theater. It is a little theater. They are in their 20th year, David. 20 years, which I think is pretty good for a small theater in any town. They had a cast of about 16 people, so the choreography was great to keep them all from running into each other. The voices were strong. They were beautiful. You could understand every word that they sang and every word that they spoke, which is becoming harder and harder, I think, to do in theater today, because usually the band will run right over the top of the songs and you can't hear them. They had a pianist and a flutist on stage during the performance. So I would suggest that anybody that wants to have a really wonderful time and laugh a lot out loud, go and see it. It's at the Eureka Theater, Of Thee I Sing. It, of course, is a nonprofit, and it's running through the 21st of October.
I believe it's Eureka Theater with an R-E
dot
org.
Oh, of course
is
it is.
Correct?
They all are.
So yeah, and I might add, I've been down to that 42nd Street a number of times, and I think what Diane is saying is that the audience is kind of involved. It's not a huge auditorium. Sometimes they do productions on book, so they're actually holding the book or the script in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
And in a strange way, when you go to one of those type of productions, you actually do focus on the words more. They also tend to revive the lesser shows which may have made it in Broadway in the 1930s and 1940s. And it's a interesting learning curve, because the people who wrote those were often on the way up. So you get a sense of where Gershwin was in 1930 or where Cole Porter might have been. So I think it's a interesting piece of musical history that they present.
Well, before we move on to some other reviews, let's hear a little excerpt of Thee I Sing, music of George Gershwin. This is Wintergreen for President. The Eureka Theater is presenting this, Of Thee I Sing, eurekatheater.org.
And the next one, as Peter was saying, the next one they're going to do is coming up soon. It was originally called Carmelina, and then it went on to be Buena Sera, Mrs. Campbell, which went on to be, what is it, that thing that ABBA did?
Mamma Mia.
Yeah, which went on to be Mamma Mia. So it's interesting. So after that one, then they're going to be Little Me, which I haven't seen in like 40 years. But
okay. Peter, tell us what you've been working on.
Yeah, well, actually, just talking of musicals, I think one of the trends which has been developing in London, because I've just come back from doing some writing about the city and the countryside in England, is that there are at least 12 major musicals running in London. So I think it is now competing with Broadway in terms of where you would go, where you would normally associate, when I say serious theatre, I suppose I'm talking about high-end theatre. So some of the old revivals like Top Hat, shows which have been over here like Stomp, but also contemporary. The Phantom of the Opera is now in its 25th year. The Lion King is playing down in Piccadilly. And then kind of musical revivals, Let It Be, the story about the Beatles. Michael Jackson's Thriller is running. Jersey Boys is there. We've just mentioned Mamma Mia, Les Miserables. So really you're running into what could have been Broadway about 10, 15 years ago is now live and living in London, even including Shrek, the musical. So I had to sort of search my papers out to find what I call English theatre. And at the Old Vic, the good news is they did have Much Ado About Nothing, which is a good production. And interestingly enough, they've opened a new theatre. It's called the Pinter Theatre. The Pinter is obviously named after Harold Pinter. Ironically, it used to be the Comedy. I'm sure Pinter would have found something amusing in one of his very heavy plays, where Silence is Golden being put on at the Pinter, which was the Comedy. And they're running an Alan Ayckbourn play called A Chorus of Disapproval. Now, anyone going to London, two or three quick tips. When the weather's good, and I was blessed with good weather, I think it's a great walking city because you can read history in the buildings as you go past them. And two or three trips are worth making. The Churchill cabinet rooms just down from Buckingham Palace have been created exactly as they were in 1940 when the Second World War, of course, was already in its first year in England. And this is a remarkable piece of history, hands-on history. They've also got wax models of the generals and Churchill himself sitting there. Plus, you're in the heart of London. You're just off Trafalgar Square. You've got Nelson looking down from the column. So you feel that you're in the city. The other thing I recommend is taking a boat trip. There are two ways you can go on the River Thames. One is down to Hampton Court, which is the ancestral home of Henry VIII, and people may remember it from the movie A Man for All Seasons. And then you can go south up towards Greenwich, and they have the Cutty Sark restored. This is an old tea clipper that actually did make trips to San Francisco. And, of course, the great thing about travelling by boat along the River Thames is that you get a sense of the city's skyline. So you'll see St. Paul's with its dome lit up. You'll see the Houses of Commons. In fact, it's a whole different view to a walker's London. So that would be my one suggestion. I was also up at Oxford taking part in a conference, and it was mainly foreign correspondents focusing on the Middle East. And I'll just draw attention to one item which got very little coverage in November last year. And I've asked several people since I've been back, did they know this? And that is that the British Embassy in Tehran was actually burnt down. It was a protest, probably organised by the Iranian government, and it came and went almost at the flick of an eyelid. And I think it really centred on the use of sanctions. And I think, ironically, now, 6 months later, 9 months later, we've actually seen the impact of sanctions since the Iranian currency has changed. So that's historic London, that's contemporary London, that's contemporary Oxford, a city to discover on your feet.
Sure, yeah. Well, let's bring some things closer to home here, Peter. I understand you've also been over to the Mill Valley Film Festival.
Yeah, the Mill Valley Film Festival is now at the end of its first week, and I'm going to focus on one particular film, partly because of the Iranian crisis actually being on my mind. And this is a wonderful movie. It's called Argo, A-R-G-O. It's directed by Ben Affleck. And it centers on a true story when, in fact, the American embassy was occupied, taken over, and the hostages were seized. So we're back in the year 1979. And now, although the bulk of the hostages were in the American embassy, six managed to find refuge in the Canadian ambassador's house. This is the story of how the six escaped and what role the CIA played in enabling that escape. It's based on a book called Master of Disguise. It's by Antonio Mendez, and he actually plays the author. And so, vision that you're now in Tehran, the year 1879, and the Canadians actually played a major role in offering shelter to these six Americans. And the story, it doesn't in any sense ruin it, is the CIA set up a phony film company, and they create actors, and hence the title of the book, the original book, Master of Disguise. They disguise these particular hostages as actors, and in the end, they finally make it to freedom.
It opens widely on Friday, in fact.
I was just going to add, in fact, it's moved from the festival to Friday, and I think it's one of the best thrillers I've seen for a long time. It first aired in Toronto, and that's where I saw it at the Toronto Film Festival. And at the time, the ambassador, Kenneth Taylor, that is the Canadian ambassador, didn't feel they got exactly enough credit for their role. And it's interesting that Ben Affleck has actually put a postscript on this and says that because it's based on a true story rather than a true story. They've had some dramatic license, but they did want to recognise and compliment both the CIA and the Canadian Embassy for helping free the six. So I think it's interesting how a film opens in Canada, opens this time in Toronto, comes down here to Mill Valley, and the actual director, Ben Affleck, has made a change.
What's coming up in the next week of the festival?
Two or three different ones. One which I enjoyed is actually called Edge of Watch, and that's actually now just gone on general release. It's set in South Los Angeles. It's a story about friendship and partnership in the L.A. police force, and it was a remarkable film. It was shot in more or less 6 weeks, and a lot of the shooting is from inside the police cars as they go through all the various types of hazards a cop working in the south section of Los Angeles is likely to face. So it's a cross between a documentary, a cross between what I call friendship. But I think what was authentic in this particular one and is the dialogue between the two policemen, because you feel you are in that back seat, you're a fly on the wall, you're listening in. And it covers everything from drug dealing to saving a child from a fire to a final death.
Right. So, well, let me get one more word in with Diane before we have to say goodbye. Peter, I'm hoping we'll have a little bit more time to talk about that. Diane, something coming up quickly?
Well, something I saw the other day, which is called 33 Variations, and it is a wonderful play. It's done by Theater Works, and it's at the down south on the peninsula, of course, and it is a magnificent play. It's incredible the way that they have managed to put together something that's going on today with a woman who was studying Beethoven and Beethoven's writing of the 33 Variations. There is Liberatore's on stage at all times at the grand piano playing in the background. You don't know he's there, but it's magnificent. And the way they have created these two stories to work side by side from the 1800s and today is absolutely incredible. And there's some really outstanding things that happen, and I suggest anyone that wants to please go and see it. It's there through October 28th at the Mountain View Center for Performing Arts. It's called 33 Variations by Theater Works.
Great, Peter. A pick of something to see this coming week. Give us something.
Well, the San Francisco Literary Society is replaying a great classic. It's called Tunes of Glory. It has John Mills and Alec Guinness. It's a story of a regiment, a story of loyalty, and of course, you're going to hear bagpipes. And the one thing I can say about bagpipes is a gentleman is somebody who knows how to play a bagpipe but doesn't. And so I will leave that thought with you. Tunes of Glory. And to reach that, the number to call is 415-381-6671. That's the San Francisco Literary Society screening Tunes of Glory.
Thank you, Peter. We'll see you again soon. Diane, thanks for stopping in.
Been good.
More time next time.
Good.
I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW.